Hello, everyone, and welcome to the MacroCast. I'm your host, Ilan Mui, a managing director at Penta. Brendan Walsh and John Fagan of Markets Policy Partners are also behind the wheel today. And our very special guest, riding shotgun, is Nick Bunker, director for North American Research at the hiring platform Indeed. Nick, we're so glad to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Well, we've got a lot of economic news to discuss today, GDP, inflation, the Fed's meeting next week. And in fact, the data has looked so good that our friends at Axios are saying that this isn't a soft landing. This is actually no landing at all. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the soft landing debate, I think what I was thinking about, particularly this morning when you got the recent batch of core PCE data, was what Austin Goolsbee at the Chicago Fed's been saying, sort of like the golden path, which when he talks about it, sort of like even the better version of the soft landing. And, you know, at least so far, we are seem to be trotting along that. I just was looking at, you know, one way to think about this is at the end of 2022, Fed had the December meeting, they put out their projections for what they thought the end of 2023 would look like. And at that point, they were projecting, or at least the median participant was projecting, unemployment would be about 4.6% and core inflation would be 3.5% in the fourth quarter. And what we got was something closer to an unemployment rate of about 3.7% and core PC growth, at least through December, of 2.9%. So we got more disinflation with a much smaller increase in unemployment. So that's, I think, very encouraging. Never mind the fact that we also got news today that, you know, on a year-over-year basis, GDP was growing at like 3% after adjusting for inflation. So, yeah, I don't know if we've, you know, I don't know the proper plane metaphor here, but things are looking pretty good for the U.S. economy. We've gotten resilient economic growth. Looks like there's a lot of the disinflation we've gotten is from supply side increases. So, I guess it's sort of the opposite of stagflation in many ways. That we've gotten continued strong growth and disinflation at the same time. So very positive, and hopefully a lot of these, you know, trends continue into 2024, or we're, you know, we continue walking along this golden path.
Yeah, definitely the consumer has been, you know, one of the pillars of, now I'm trying to think of a traveling metaphor to go along with the golden path, that the consumer has been trudging down the golden path for quite some time now. And they really were, you know, the driver of the strong GDP numbers that we saw. What do you think has been behind that continued resilience of the consumer?
So I think for a large part of the last few years, folks have been talking about excess savings or fiscal stimulus. And what I've noted, particularly from my vantage point, thing about the U.S. labor market, it's what we're seeing in real wage gains. That since 2021, particularly spring, summer, we're seeing very rapid nominal wage gains. But for many folks, inflation was faster than wage growth. That's no longer the case. You can see, especially since this summer, maybe early fall, average wages are outpacing inflation now. And if there's some ways you can cut the data, at least from, you know, the survey behind the unemployment rate, most workers are getting inflation adjusted wages right now. So I think part of the resilience, at least over the last few months, and hopefully ahead moving ahead, is that we have seen wage growth in nominal terms moderate, but still be fairly resilient, and inflation's come down faster. So there's more folks who are getting inflation adjusted increases in their paycheck. So their purchasing power is rising, so that you continue to see consumption grow. So I think that's, again, this idea of, you know, sort of a positive feedback loop. The labor market stays strong enough, inflation's come down, and that seems, at least for now, to be a source that's continues powering consumption growth ahead.
And Nick, when you look at this, you know, you're at an interesting company that probably has a lot of interesting data. How much of the, you know, what you see internally kind of informs your decision, not your decision, but your view on the economy?
Yeah, so I think there's sort of, I guess there's two aspects. I mean, there's a variety of aspects, but I'll talk about two. One is the continued resilience of the labor market, and the second is what I was just talking about with real wage gains. So the first is, in terms of the resilience, a data set that has become more prominent over the past few years has been the government's measure of job openings from the Job Openings Labor Turnover Survey. in part because it was signaling, hey, there's lots of really rapid demand for workers. And it's been a sign of labor market tightness. What we've done at Indeed, strictly hiring lab, the team that I am part of, is we've developed our job postings index.
Yeah.
So that's a measure of...
The jolt is pretty slow. We're getting a couple months, you know, behind.
Yeah. So our job postings index, it's a daily measure. To your point about speed...
Oh, wow.
So it is a daily measure, and release it weekly. So the latest government data is through the end of November.
Yeah.
I've got data from a week ago.
And on that is so cool.
Monday or Tuesday, I'll have data from today.
Yeah.
And so we've got...
And you personally get it every day.
So yeah, there's a query I run every morning to be like, a quick check on it. So
it's almost like cheating. You're getting a look behind the scenes. Is that fair?
It's one of the advantages of having my job. But what we share publicly, that comes out on a weekly cadence. So depending on when our data is rolled out, sometimes we've got about a 4 to 6 week front run. I won't call it cheating on what we're seeing from the government data. And in terms of how that stacks up the government data, this is a podcast. Otherwise, I'd show a graph. But what you can see is that basically look at both series, our job postings index, Jolt's job opening series right before the pandemic. They basically map onto each other fairly well with two big differences. One is the timeliness that we just talked about. And then there's Jolt's is more volatile. It jumps. It's only a monthly series. It's a survey. That's what the S in Jolt stands for.
Yeah. And it's not that many people, right?
It's about 60,000, I think, establishments overall, somewhere in the 40 to 50 range. 50,000. But the response rate has come down significantly. This has happened for quite a few government surveys, especially in the early days of the pandemic. Some of them have bounced back. Jolt's, it dropped significantly.
Wow.
And then there's our data, which is based on what we're seeing on our platform.
Right? Yeah.
It's user-based. It's not a survey. It's what we can see in the platform. And it's more timely. But on the long run, it's essentially the same trend. So what I can see in our data, again, this is through a week ago, so January 19th, is that job postings are still elevated compared to their pre-pandemic level. They're up about 23% from what we saw back in the beginning of February 2020. Now, that's down a lot from what we're seeing in basically January of 2022, when our series peaked. It's down 25% from that level. It's pulled back significantly, but it's still quite elevated. So I think that, to me, in terms of the continued resilience of the labor market, is that we still see a low unemployment rate. We still see signs of hiring. And from our data, we can see continued strong demand for workers, signaling that, hey, this is a labor market that has moderated. It's a labor market that's in many ways come back into a more sustainable balance, but there's still healthy demand for workers, particularly in the sectors that tend to employ more workers. So food prep and services, nursing, childcare, those are all very elevated. I think nursing job postings are up 38% from the pre-pandemic level. Childcare is like 43%. So there's lots of demand there.
Well, I can say, number one, we all have a great demand for childcare today because we were just talking before this, this podcast began on the fact that schools are closed. So that's just a personal note. The second thing, I will let our listeners know that Nick Bunker is a Jolt junkie. So you are not throwing shade on the government data at all, but, you know, maybe supplementing.
Yes.
Supplementing its findings with what you see on your own private platform.
Yes, I have the privilege to get to work with our data, which is fantastic. I'm also a person who is hitting Command R repeatedly at 10 a.m. every month when the Jolt's report comes out. So I think our data is incredibly useful, but it is a complement to complement to something you very much should use in conjunction with government data. My view is, and I could talk about some of our other data, is our data products we're trying to do, help inform people about what's happening in labor markets. So our data, the JPI I just mentioned, we have US data, but we also have data for six, seven other countries more. So we have data that gets released for Canada, the UK, Ireland, Germany, France, and Australia. And then we have some other markets that we have as well, because our team's international. But yeah, so I think it's our data. I think I will talk about the utility of our data till the cows come home, but also government data is incredibly important. And yeah, definitely don't want to throw shade on it at all, in part because there's great measures from JOLTS that our data can't directly speak to, like say the quits rate.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is a very rosy picture that we're talking about, and the data has just come in, and it has been Goldilocks, the golden path, whatever. When you put that against, and we did see a gauge of consumer confidence get a little bit better, but generally, we've talked a lot about this disconnect between the data and the economic mood of the country, which tends to be a little bit sour. Where do you come down on that particular issue?
Yeah, so I think my very simple explanation for it is we're talking about how there's been a lot of disinflation. And that means that there was really elevated inflation for a period of a few years there. And I think what I've learned over the last few years as someone who doesn't have personal experience with the elevated inflation rates of, say, the 70s, is that people really hate high inflation. They really, really, really don't like it. Especially when, for most people, that growing faster than their wages. So I think, as I referenced earlier, that wages are starting to exceed inflation again, and that there's got to be a period of time where that sort of catches up to people's lived experiences. And that in my first approximation, inflation was high. People don't like that. And as that wanes, maybe we've seen it in a few data sets in very recently, is that once that starts to trickle into people's lives, they feel better about the economy.
Yeah, that's an interesting formulation. The idea that the golden path and growth is going to be steady. You get that disinflation, and the real wages are running ahead of it, and people are feeling better. Is that the kind of scenario? That's not the kind of scenario you typically have the Fed cutting rates into. and yet, we've got a Fed meeting coming up next week. The odds implied in futures markets are for 97% likelihood that they hold, but the odds flip to 50-50 essentially in the March meeting. And so how do you, and for the full year, the base case is still around 125, 150 basis points of total cuts. How do you square that with the economic signals that you're seeing?
Yeah. So I guess the way I think about this is that the way the Fed has talked about their interest rates is that they currently view them as restrictive, that it's actually slowed things down, that it's doing the job of of being restrictive enough on economic activity that's brought inflation down, or it's at least has contributed to the disinflation. And if they think it's restrictive now, and it's been restrictive for quite some time, if the economy has gotten to a spot where inflation's at or right above their target, the labor market's still holding up, they got to ease off at some point, right? The way they've talked about it is that, hey, this has been restrictive. If it's been restrictive some time, if you've been, if you're on this path and the brake's been down for quite some time and you want to keep going there, you need to ease off the brake at some point. So that's how I've been thinking about it, is that they view that they've been, pedal to the metal, but the pedal they've been pushing is the brake. And now they need to ease off a little bit in order to continue along the positive trajectory we're on so far right now.
What do you think the risk of a policy mistake on their front, that they stay kind of on hold for too long? Do you think that the economy needs a little, less tightness?
So I don't know if I think my view of it is that what you can see in the inflation data so far is that things have come down. It's not on a year-over-year basis. It's not back to the Fed's target, but look at the 6 month, it essentially is. But that there is this risk that if you do think rates are restrictive, and if you're holding there for quite some time, the labor market has moderated and still resilient. But if you look at a lot of the data, it's sort of come down and maybe leveling off. But the risk is that it's, take non-farm payrolls, for example. They've slowed down quite a bit and maybe they start to level off, or maybe they keep going. And the risk is that in a lot of labor market data so far, it's looked towards moderation, but there's some point where it keeps going and then it's no longer moderation, it's deterioration.
Right, right.
So I think that's the risk there, is that the trends look very benign right now, but they could accelerate quickly, potentially, or they can just keep going. They can settle in for a landing, or they can keep declining. So I think my view is that, at least with the data so far, I don't think they need to like urgently cut right now because there's any risk of like, you know, a recession starting like next month, right, or exactly. anything. Yeah. But it is like it over time, as the inflation data comes in more and more benign, the risk is going to start tilting towards, okay, if this is restrictive,
you're, yeah. And one thing that we've been talking about the last couple of weeks is the cost of shipping goods because of the situation in the Red Sea. But I kind of keep going over in my head. So if we know that goods are going up because you have to send it 40% longer around Africa, and also that's why oil's going up, and then you're worried, okay, that's seeping into inflation, but we know exactly why it's happening. And stricter rates might exacerbate that problem. You know, cutting rates might be the solution to, you know, now a company can borrow cheaper so that maybe you can pass that on and it doesn't end up with the consumer. I'd be interested in your view on it. I haven't fully thought it out yet, you know, but it seems like one of those that we actually, it's not a theoretical inflation thing. We know exactly why that cost is going up, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's also the traditional central banking playbook, as I understand it, is that when you have a supply shock like that and it looks quite temporary, is that you don't tighten into it, because I mean, how much are interest rates going to affect the geopolitical situation? Yeah. So it is.
Rates are higher. We're done.
Yeah. I think there's some interesting theories on monetary policy transmission. I don't know if that's one that has much grounding in theory or empirics.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it is one of those that, yes, it's a risk. It's out there, but it's one that you can monitor. And also, if you're at the Fed and you think rates are restrictive right now, it seems unlikely that it'd hike. They'd maybe just hold it for longer. And it does seem like what they're saying right now is, you know, they're saying, hey, we're not thinking about this, but maybe they are about cutting. So they can just slow play it a little bit. And again, if the conversation is about, do they start cutting in March? They start cutting in May. Maybe they have some time there.
Yeah. So the market's already starting to price that in. And so, you know, their decision is also front run, you know, partially by the market.
Yeah, I mean, I'll point out it was the Fed that brought up the idea of rate cuts, right? This was didn't happen. Markets didn't react in a complete vacuum. So, you know, it's something that is part of the discussion, is at least in, you know, in the view scope at this point, even if the actual date is uncertain. And John, I mean, I know that it's like a coin flip now, right, for the March meeting, but that's actually come down quite a bit from where markets originally were, when they felt like March was a guaranteed to see the Fed starting to slice.
Yeah, absolutely. The Fed's communication barrage, sort of after the dovish perception of the of Chair Powell's press conference after the last meeting. Yeah, we've seen a barrage of pushback from Fed officials, but the data has reinforced it. But you just see, you know, the it's an incremental, it's a gentle move. I think that the Fed, you know, for next week, our guess is that the Fed is going to remain pretty cagey. You know, it's not they've got a decent amount of time between the end January and the March 20th decision. So, you know, it's probably going to be a situation where they try to hold steady, let the data do the talking for them. And so far, the data has incrementally pushed back those rate cut expectations. Not, you know, not a ton, not a sea change, but going in the direction I think the Fed probably wants.
Yeah, but it is a communication issue because, you know, in their projections, especially June, you know, they thought inflation was going to be almost 1% higher than it is today. So, Not criticizing them, but that's just the reality that they have to communicate to the market, you know, of why we're here, and you know, and more importantly, where we think inflation is going to go in the next 3 months, because the fourth quarter proved to be, if you analyze the fourth quarter, well below their target.
The other thing that, you know, the Fed has to take into account is that, you know, obviously they say that rates are in restrictive territory, and I'm sure that they have a lot of data that shows that. But, you know, everybody knows that what's the neutral rate? It's a, just a guessing game, right? It, really, nobody knows. But what is absolutely manifest is that right now, even if rates are restrictive, financial conditions are not restrictive. If you look at, you know, metrics of financial conditions, you can, you know, there are pockets of tightness. Obviously, you know, commercial real estate is one. But you look at, you know, the Chicago Fed's gauge of financial conditions. I'm looking at it right now. It's as loose as it's been since, you know, very early 2022. And they, it's, you know,
right. On the Bloomberg, very financial conditions are low too. Yeah.
Yeah. Very easy side of where they, you know, of the last few years. So that's, you know, there's a chance that they become so pro-cyclical. And if they're just looking at models and, you know, it, at this environment, you will look at the stock market. I mean, it would be if the Fed starts sounding increasingly dovish. I mean, this could be gasoline on an already kind of roaring fire in financial markets. All time highs for the stock market. Usually the Fed doesn't cut into those, but, you know, we'll see. It's a very different context.
So it kind of begs the question, is the market doing the Fed's job for it? Do they need to cut if financial conditions are loosening just with the discussion or even with just a whiff of cutting in the air? You know, financial conditions are loosening, markets are doing the job for the Fed. So the Fed can kind of stay put, take some pressure off, that's for sure. And Nick, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I'm going to do it. I gave you some time to dodge if you need to start thinking of the pivot in your head. No, but I know you're a director of North American research, but you mentioned that Indeed does have data, you know, for a number of other countries. Do you have any sense of how the U.S. labor market compares to in the international markets? And, you know, how are we positioned compared to others?
Yeah. So what we can see in Indeed data, I think, is broadly similar to what you see in trends in other data, is that it's been, you know, a sort of broad-based rebound globally, with the U.S. being a particular pocket of strength. So I mentioned, you know, on our job postings data, that what we're seeing in the U.S. is there's been a clear moderation, but things are still elevated from the pre-pandemic levels. That's broadly what we're seeing in the other data as well. The U.K., you know, basically postings are back to their pre-pandemic level, even if they moderate quite a bit. But that's back to where it was in early 2020, which was still a pretty robust, strong labor market. You see it in German data, Canadian data. Postings are still elevated. I think somewhere in the 10 to 20% above pre-pandemic levels. Australia job postings are well above there, even the US. So demand for workers is still strong. And then another series that we put out is our Indeed wage tracker. So that looks at the growth in wages and salaries advertised in job postings on Indeed. What you see there is a relatively consistent global story that posted wage growth peaked early 2022, maybe a little bit later, and has come down. With the exception of the UK, wage growth has been more resilient there, even as it has seemed to peak. But, you know, our measure for the US and our measure for the Euro area, they're roughly at 3.8% year over year. So they're still, you know, they've come down quite a bit. And the U.S. posted wage growth peaked at a little over 9% year over year. But they are both, you know, moderating, but slightly above pre-pandemic levels. In the U.S., faster than inflation, so CPI. And again, this is posted wage growth, so maybe it's a little bit indicative of future trends in labor markets, as most measures of wage growth are realized. So again, in both these markets, you're seeing the story of, hey, it's a resilient labor markets, but ones that are sort of have reeled in some of the excess from what we saw in late 21 and early 22.
John, how are central banks internationally thinking about the labor market and inflation picture? What are we seeing in terms of, are they thinking about cuts yet?
Well, we saw the European Central Bank come in this week and hold rates. That was expected. There's been a lot of chatter about sort of when they're also discussing cuts in Europe. And I think probably with a little bit more, probably a little bit more justification on the the growth side there has been a little bit weaker. U.S. obviously outperforming. We got PMIs that came in. They were, you know, not that different than expectations in Europe, but still very much contractionary. And, you know, technical recession, that's the kind of, you know, status of the German economy and so forth. So, you know, they definitely have a leg to stand on when it comes to rate cuts. But the cautious nature, some of the sort of more calendar based guidance that we've heard coming out of the ECB is, you know, when will they have enough data, you know, assuming that it's that trends extend as they currently expect. And that's kind of finger in the wind. They've talked about sort of late, you know, late spring. The markets have them cutting earlier, but, you know, that's not as dramatic a disconnect as it might have been. So, you know, I think that there's sort of a coordinated cutting opportunity. I think one place we focused on is the UK. That has a little bit more of an inflationary problem. We've seen some upside, and the Bank of England, you know, may be, you know, among the major central banks, one of the more, you know, cautious to start easing. And then we also have the Bank of Japan, which is marching to a completely different drummer. This week, they did not move rates. They are still in. They are the last central bank standing in negative interest rate territory. Negative 10 basis points isn't dramatically negative, but wow. I mean, they have. And so they're seen hiking this year up to zero, getting out of negative territory and maybe inching above. So they would remain dramatically out of step with all the other central banks. But given the weakness of the yen, you know, it's not that big a problem. Usually you wouldn't see the Bank of Japan pull something like that because it would put rocket boosters behind the yen and they wouldn't want to see that. But the dramatic weakness, I mean, generational weakness in the yen. Great time to travel to Tokyo and Japan. Yeah. You know, it used to be so expensive. now it's a deal.
There's one thing on the ECB meeting. I mentioned I was covering North America, but I try to follow other markets. And one thing that I saw was that President Lagarde mentioned sort of like tracking wage growth. And this is a bit of a plug. She did mention the Indeed wage tracker as a measure that she's really been following in terms of wage growth metrics. That was
really quality shout out.
Yes, that was it was very exciting to see that. So just want to plug for our data is that, you know, we think it's a good measure, but some folks who make monetary policy agree with us as well. So,
wait, that's your second quality shout out, Nick. Didn't Chair Powell also reference Indeed data during one of his speeches?
He did in the Jackson Hole speech. He didn't directly reference it, but figure six of the Jackson Hole speech, not that I've thought about this a lot, he presented trends in wage growth. And there's four series, three were your classic, you know, average hourly earnings, employment cost index, and the Atlanta Fed's wage growth tracker. The fourth was our Indeed wage tracker data for the U.S.
Fantastic. I mean, obviously it's a very nerdy audience, but there really is no better press than you can get than figure six of the Fed Chair's Jackson Hole speech. So let me ask you this, as you think about the year ahead and sort of the dynamics that we've been talking about in the labor market, what else is on your radar screen and what secret data does Indeed have, or what secret data are you looking at outside of Indeed that can maybe help us inform and understand where things might be headed?
Yeah, so I think we talked about essentially labor demand, so job postings. There's obviously some other measures there. I keep an eye on, for example, for hours growth in say the publicly available data and sort of measures of part-time work. We talked about wage growth. So one thing I'm keeping an eye on, and it was one of the really big stories in the labor market last year, was labor supply. That you saw labor force participation, particularly for prime age workers, pick up a lot in 2023. In some ways, in defiance of a lot of expectations, particularly after what we saw in 21, when, hey, where's all the workers? I think they were just slower to return, like many of the supply side shocks. So there's two things that I thought were notable about last year when it came to labor force participation. One was that we got back to levels we actually hadn't seen since 2001, 2002. So it's back to 20-year highs, but it's a little bit below what we saw at its all-time peak back in the 90s, like late 90s. That's where you really saw that top out. So I think it'll be interesting to see if we can continue to make progress in that direction, particularly as you saw, the big rise in 2023 was among prime age women. So these workers, women aged 25 to 54, they were much more responsive to the labor market, or at least much more responsive over the last year, which is actually what you're seeing in 2018, 2019 as well. It seemed it was prime age women really were the more, you know, the source of growth. And then the other thing, I'll tie back to Indeed data, is immigration. That a large chunk of the increase in labor force growth since 2021 has been among foreign-born workers. If you look at a shared labor force starting in kind of 2019, dipping down to 2020 and 2021, very depressed level of labor force was foreign-born. It's risen pretty steadily and now is slightly above its pre-pandemic levels. One thing we can see on Indeed is interest in job postings or just searches on our platform from job seekers outside of a country based on their IP address. So we can see what share of searches or what percent of clicks on a job posting in the US are from outside the country. And similar to what you saw in that foreign-born share of labor force fell off during the pandemic, it started to tick back up. And depending if you look at searches or share of clicks, they're back to their pre-pandemic level or slightly above. But they both leveled off over the end of the year. So something I'm going to keep an eye on is, hey, are we going to see continued growth or a push for labor force position from foreign-born workers? And if that's something that can, you know, increase supply at a time we're seeing moderating demand, because if not, if anyone wants to see the labor market come more into balance, and I think it's questionable whether that should be a goal, but if you do, and this is something that was talked about in the Fed minutes recently, then you need to see more reduction in demand in order to get a further moderation.
And is there certain industries that you're seeing that the foreign workers are most interested in, or is it kind of broad based?
So it's varied a little bit in that you do see, you know, in terms of the overall share, it tends to be higher wage occupations like tech workers, but you also do see lots of interest in, you know, hospitality and tourism, some food preparation jobs. So it's sort of bifurcated a little bit. There's some sectors, you know, it matches up with the industries or occupations you tend to see lots of foreign interest in. So sort of, software development, very tight or scarce labor markets that have lots of, potential immigration and also some more manual labor.
Anything for economic policy podcast co-hosts?
You know what? I haven't looked at that data. Maybe I can...
It's a very small sample size.
Yeah. I think, I don't know how many postings there are.
Yeah, we also do it for free, so it's not that interesting.
So I guess you can't actually call it labor, right? If we don't actually get income from it. Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate all your insights. That does it for us at the MacroCast. I'm Ilan Moy with Penta. Thank you to my co-hosts, John and Brendan of Markets Policy Partners. Again, that was Nick Bunker, Director of North American Research at the hiring platform Indeed. We hope that you all enjoyed our show. Thank you for listening. And remember that you can always subscribe to the MacroCast wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great day.